Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneer Zalman Neufeld. America's community colleges are facing a completion crisis. The college-going experience of too many students is interrupted, lengthening their time to completing a degree, or worse, causing many to drop out altogether. In The Costs of Completion, published by Johns Hopkins University Press in 2021, Robin Isserles contextualizes this crisis by placing blame on the neoliberal policies that have shaped public community colleges over the past 30 years. The Costs of Completion offers a deeper, more complex understanding of who community college students are, why and how they enroll, and what higher education institutions can do to better support them and help them flourish. Robin Isserles is a professor of sociology at the Borough of Manhattan Community College of the City University of New York. She's a dear friend and colleague, and I'm so glad her new book has brought her to our program. Welcome, Robin.
Hi, thanks, Alman. Thanks so much for having me.
So to get started, could you tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
So a few things. I'm what I've called myself a third generation CUNY student. My grandmother
CUNY is a City University of New York.
University of New York, correct. My grandmother, single parent, went back to school at what was called then called City College Downtown, which later became Baruch College, and put herself through college one class at a time. More in the summer when she shipped my mother and my uncle to summer camp, and became a teacher in the New York City public schools. Both my parents attended Queens College, and I went to the Graduate Center to pursue my PhD. So I tell my students that CUNY is in my blood. I feel very committed to this incredibly important public institution and what it does for so many, what it has done and what it continues to do for so many people in New York City. The other motivating part, so I've been teaching at BMCC, Borough of Manhattan Community College, for over 20 years now. And I've been a witness to so many of the changes and the proposed solutions of how we can, serve students better. From 2011 to 2013, I actually left BMCC for 2 years to direct a research project looking at academic momentum of community college students in CUNY. And academic momentum, which I get into in the book, is this theory that the more students are integrated into their education, especially in the first year, the more classes they take, the more, academically and socially integrated they are, the more likely that they will persist and graduate on time. So I was invited to be part of this, multi-year project, looking at whether this is a theory that works on community college students, because when it was first researched, community colleges were not part of the analysis. And so a lot of what I've been thinking about was shaped and informed by working on that research project and then having that be a place or, and a time for me to think more introspectively of what I was doing in the classroom. And it led me to this book because a lot of the direction that we've been taking to address this so-called completion crisis, I think does not work for the majority of our students, especially those who are much more academically or and or economically precarious.
Right, right. So thank you for that. To help listeners who are not familiar with this, what are community colleges? Well, let's start with that.
So community colleges started in the early 1900s. They were called junior colleges. And you know, the thing about community colleges is they've always had multiple purposes. They were always about workforce development. They were always about pre-college programs to develop educators, for example. But they were called junior colleges. The name community college became more in fashion in the later on in the 1950s, 1960s. As we began to include more and more people into higher ed, community colleges became more of a home for some, you know, many of the students who perhaps never thought of themselves as college students. And that's, you know, the more recent incarnation of the community colleges. So community colleges, they exist in urban areas and cities, they exist in rural areas. They're places for people who leave the workforce, who want to reskill or retool. They are for high school graduates or students who get GED equivalent, you know, high school equivalencies to as a first step in their college journey. More and more, they are places for students to spend the first 2 years of their education in a way to save some money, given the very high cost of college in the United States. They're for older students, students who have been in the workforce for a long time, maybe retire and want to take a few classes that they've never pursued before, or for women who didn't pursue an education and had families to return to follow their degree. Their degree path. So it's really it's a kind of an amazing experience, and certainly it we see this in the classrooms, right? When we have such a diversity of students in terms of why they're sitting in our classrooms.
Absolutely. Just to give us a little more of a sense of the community college landscape, approximately how many community colleges are there throughout the United States? And I mean a rough estimate. And do we have a sense of, again, just a rough estimate of approximately how many students are enrolled in community colleges throughout the United States? Just so we have a sense of what, you know, the proportions of the universe that we're talking about.
So there's about, I would say, I think there's around close to 1,500 community colleges. Most of them are public, but not all of them. I'm very bad at recalling statistics.
Me too.
Oh, good. Okay.
Me too. Definitely. I mean, just a ballpark figure. We're talking about a million students. We're talking about, you know, some sense of the proportions. If you could think of that. If not, that's not really, it's not urgent.
So there's, at CUNY, I know. This is from about 2019. There's about almost 8 million students enrolled in two-year schools.
Wow.
Although the two-year school designation is also going under some level of transformation because there's so many schools now with dual programs. They offer both an associate's degree, which is the normal community college degree, but also bachelor level degrees. Mm. And so they are no longer counted as community colleges. So it's, there's some fuzziness around the numbers.
Sure.
So, but about 8 million students. In the fall of 2020, there were about almost 5 million enrolled, which makes up about 30% of our undergraduate students. And I will say that more are part-time. About 3 million are part-time about 1.5 million are full-time. And CUNY is actually the opposite. CUNY has more full-time than part-time. So CUNY deviates sometimes from some of the national trends.
Right. I see. Okay. Well, thank you for that. So I'm curious, you start at the outset of your book, you talk about how your own undergraduate experience and the role or the place of college in your life was significantly different from the approach to college of many of the students at community colleges. Could you talk a little bit about that? What are those differences?
Sure. I mean, I think that one of the salient features that we need more attention to in this conversation is about social class and its role and how we think about college education, how we're, in our families. I think there's not as much of a difference anymore by class of the importance of a college education. I think you find that crosses class boundaries, but about the enculturation around college, especially, you know, at the community college, many of our students are first generation. I call them first generation-ish students because a lot of them have had parents who have gone to college. But there's a different kind of family socialization around college going than I think happens in many middle class or more what we call traditional college students' lives. And also, I was writing this during the time that my own daughter was also going through the college process, and I was noting some of the differences. You know, when you are thinking about applying to a college as a residential student, one who lives on campus, oftentimes far away from home. It's a very different experience. You go, you know, you start to research the schools that you're interested in. You're thinking, you're placing yourself there emotionally, cognitively, if you will. You are talking to lots of people about their college experiences. You are visiting the campuses, taking a tour, imagining yourself at school. And I think many community college students, that is not the same process. And I think that those factors create a kind of pre-college experience that lends itself to some important differences that need to be thought about and considered when we're thinking about how to engage community college students, how to keep them in school. It's not a judgment at all. It's just noting these differences that for the most part, community college students enroll based on cost and location are the two primary factors. And that makes sense, but that's a very different set of questions and assumptions than your more traditional college student at a residential school. And this would also be true of, you know, private or public four-year colleges.
Right, right. And what is college for all, this term, what does that refer to?
So we started to see an emphasis in the, going back to the 1990s, as there were a lot of comparisons, comparing the United States with other, economically similar countries about college rates and workforce and the connection. And there became this sort of trend that we should be pushing everyone to go to college. There was people in one camp thinking that this was about the competition of the American, economic model, that we need more college educated workers. I think that there were some people who are more socially justice minded who thought that we really should be democratizing higher ed. And so it came from a variety of forces. But it was, about making college a viable choice for more and more students rather than what we had in the past, in different times and places, certainly, where, certain people were left out of that college equation.
Right. And so on the face of it, certainly, this sounds like a very positive thing, definitely as a college professor, but even just as an American citizen who cares deeply about education and knowledge acquisition, it would seem like throwing the doors open are throwing the doors of colleges and universities open for all to enter, this would seem like an inherently good thing. Are you saying that there were sort of unintended consequences or blind spots in this vision of college for all?
So you're right. Ideally, it is a good thing. So there's a few things. I think some of the all those is that it's conceivable and possible that not everyone does want to go to college. And what are their options? And so at the same time that we were pushing college for all, we were also diminishing the other options like vocational programs. Now, in the past, vocational, which was more kind of career or workforce preparation, those tended to be open to more marginalized students, right? So there was, some deep stratification of who we considered college and who we considered not college. So we don't necessarily want to return to that. But this sort of betrayal of our vocational education, I think, was happening at the same time. And so that also, I think, funneled more and more people into the college routes. But a more problematic set of occurrences was that as we were expanding, or what we call democratizing, higher education, we were funding it less and less. So our public funding of public education, higher ed especially, was diminishing considerably at the same time. So we were both inviting people in, but making the institutions much more difficult to manage all of these newcomers to education. And I do think that this is a very important backstory to the completion crisis and some of the struggles that our students experience at the community college.
Right. So to get into that a little more, your book talks a lot about neoliberalism and its impact on higher education. For people who are not familiar with this term, what exactly is neoliberalism and what impact does it have on institutions of higher education?
So great question, and a really important piece of the story. So neoliberalism is a political and economic philosophy that is predicated on a few things, on the idea of, the state being really not having much intervention in our public lives, and a diminishing role of the state in producing a social good. For some of our European listeners and others, they're going to think this is a crazy notion, but this is very, very American, but it has been the leading economic and political philosophy now since, the 1980s. And the consequences of this are many. So it means divesting in public goods, public libraries, public schools, public health, and to replace that public investment, we rely on the marketplace. So we rely on what's called the free market, and that is understood as a better purveyor of carrying, of meeting these needs, these goods and services. And it has had a dramatic effect on our entire society and how we think of ourselves, right? I think it has had an impact in how we think of our participation in our own governing when we are reduced to taxpayer, right, or consumer as our primary identities. It affects how we vote and how often we vote or not, and it affects how we think about the public good and funding it. In terms of higher ed, I think that it has been a large part of the cause and the consequence of the defunding of public higher ed. So the shrinking of budgets towards public colleges. And then that translates very much to diminishing of full-time faculty and replacing full-time faculty with what we call adjunct or contingent labor. So people on, part-time contracts who with disproportionately low pay, no expectation that they're part of the larger community of the college in terms of major decision-making, that erodes the quality of education that we offer. It turns our students into consumers of their education. You know, I don't know if you've experienced this in your classroom, but I hear oftentimes my students talk about, well, you know, I'm paying for this class so that, you know, they've absorbed this language, and we have too. You know, I think faculty have as well. You know, so we become we embrace this sort of corporate style mindfulness around education. So we talk in the language of best practices or return on investments. It seeps into the way we think about ourselves in the institutions, and that makes metrics of success like completion rates and retention rates, though not unimportant, these become the primary ways in which we think about how we shape and reshape the institution. And what gets lost is learning. What gets lost is, healthy dialogue around the directions we should take to help the very, very different, you know, needs that we have in our, you know, among those who go to our institutions.
Right. And you mentioned already this idea of academic momentum that you mentioned in the book, that Clifford Edelman came up with this concept of academic momentum, that you want to keep students engaged from the very beginning of their college experience and have them as engaged as possible, including the sort of the maximum number of courses that they could take, as well as kind of social programming within the college in order to really solidify their, you know, their presence in the college and to ensure that they continue to complete their degree. Again, a little bit like College for All, this would seem on the surface to be a very good thing, right? Don't we want students to be very engaged in their college experience? Isn't this an obvious good to keep academic momentum going? What exactly is the kind of blind side or the shortcomings of this concept and of this vision of academic success?
So, I think part of this answer is that when we try to bring the theories to light in practice, there is often breakdown. And I think that some of that is we have to take a look at what our assumptions are. When Clifford Edelman did his work, his research developing this idea of academic momentum, as I mentioned before, it was done exclusively on four-year colleges and the students who attend there. So community colleges were left out of the original research. The project that I was involved with back in 2011 to 2013, on CUNY, we decidedly and purposefully just looked at community college students. And so, again, just to revisit this theory, the idea, it's kind of like the physics theory of momentum, right? Like a snowball effect, right? That the more it gains, you know, as the snowball goes down the mountain and it gets bigger and bigger, you know, and so the idea is students come into a college, and the more that they are integrated in academically and socially, the more likely they will remain, they'll retain semester after semester, and that they'll finish in a timely manner. And it does make sense kind of intuitively. But the breakdown is really about, well, who are these students and how and why do they enroll and what are their patterns of enrollment? And that is really, you know, again, kind of the centerpiece of my book, because it doesn't match very well, in my opinion, the real lives of many, many community college students. You know, the way that momentum has been done in practice in many institutions, but certainly at CUNY, you mentioned before the 15 credits. So for a student to be considered full-time, certainly for financial aid eligibility, is 12 credits. Now, if you do the math, right, at a community college and a student takes, you know, 12 credits a semester, 24 a year, they're not going to graduate in 2 years or 3 years with the number of credits that they need. Secondly, our financial aid, the federal financial aid, anything above 12 credits you can take, and, you know, it's all covered for you. So this idea of academic momentum became sort of a fixture in many of the minds of the administrations and community colleges around the country, certainly at CUNY. And so there was all these analyses done that our students were, you know, not taking enough credits to get them through faster. So what's the solution? Well, let's encourage more course taking.
Just to interject for 1 second, in case people are not familiar with the American system of education, when we talk about credits, a typical course is 3 credits. So if we think of a full course load as 12 credits, that would be 4 courses that the student would take in a semester. And if we say no, instead of taking 12, they should really take 15. So we're really saying that students should take 5 courses each semester in order to complete their degree as quickly as possible.
Right. And for some students, that could work. For most students, though, and this was, I know what I was seeing in my classes, and this has been part of my experience teaching at BMCC for 20 years, 20 plus, is that for the majority of students, that's not a very good model, because it is divorced from who they are and what their needs are, you know, both inside and outside the classroom. There were a few highlighted projects around CUNY and elsewhere where students with a B average or more, for example, when it came time to register, would get a pop-up message and their, you know, online registration, which is another part of this kind of neoliberal school, like do-it-yourself model. You know, you are eligible to take another 3-credit class. And, you know, so a student might say, hey, wow, that sounds great. And very often they may find an online class to do that because that will save them time and transportation costs and all that. So you had students who were, you know, pushed to take 15 credits, what I call, you know, taking school in hyperspeed. And what they were learning, how they were developing, became, you know, pushed way down on the priority list. It was all about getting them through. And this is a very different way of educating, certainly than their more wealthier counterparts at, you know, certainly more selective schools. And so this becomes a really important equity question of what kind of education do we want to have for students, especially who are, you know, again, the most academically and economically vulnerable. And, you know, as a teacher in these classrooms, that's not enough for me. That's not enough for my students. And this was the trend. These were some of the trends. Others, you know, were right now overhauling our whole remediation process. So students who need to develop some academic skills before they're what's called college ready. And this has been an important role in many community colleges for some time. You know, there were some troubling aspects to the way that remediation was done, and we uncovered some in the project that we did. What we're seeing is this, you know, vast change in how we are determining who is eligible for remediation. We are compressing classes, shortening the time frame. We are combining credit bearing and non-credit bearing remedial classes together, and it's for the sake of completion. And so, right, again, the priority is shifting from this metric to, you know, towards this metric and away from what we're offering students.
Right, and you mentioned about remediation courses, and how essentially for a long time, community colleges offered remediation courses, you know, basic courses in English, reading, in math, in key skills that students would need in college if they came in and scored, you know, below a certain level, and it was clear that they needed extra help in those areas. So what happened, or what is happening to those remediation courses in college campuses, in community colleges?
So some are being transformed. So like at CUNY, we're seeing what we're calling co-requisite classes. So we're combining, let's say, a higher level remedial course. So the last before you get to the college, you know, with a college credit course. So, you know, we call them 101.5 classes, right? And it's not, we don't know yet some of the impact, but I was troubled by this trend because there was a lot about the remedial quagmire, what it was called, that I think needed more research and attention. So one of the findings that kind of surprised me in our book, when we spoke to our students about their remedial experiences, at CUNY, students would, when they came in to register, you know, there was like it was a great example of Weber's bureaucracy. You know, like they were sent to one office and, you know, financial aid office, and one among the many offices they were sent to was the testing office to take a test. The vast majority of the students we spoke to, and this was consistent in my own classes with my own students, did not know the purpose for this test when they sat and they took it. For some of these students back in the day, they didn't, that was the first test they took on a computer. Wow. For some students who finished their math requirement in New York City public schools in the 10th grade and haven't taken math in a few years, were expected to recall, you know, basic algebra. And so a lot of the failures were the failures, in my opinion, of how this was done, the process by which we determined. And so that's what I mean by there were some issues to address with remediation. But the reason why it took such a quick turn towards these newer changes was because remediation was keeping students from graduating. Like that, again, so that became the motivating force. You know, there was a lot that could have been done before we got to that point of radically changing. And maybe it will prove to be a success. I don't know. I worry that, you know, if students need the time to develop some of their reading and reading comprehension skills. You know, this is important for us in a Sociology 100 class so that the readings that we choose is something that our students can master. And if we're pushing them to take a college level class and they're not getting the kinds of development skill building that they need, what does that mean for their success? What does that mean? You know, they may get the credits accumulated, but what does it mean for the quality of the learning that they're doing, that they're capable of? Because we, you know, that there's a lot of fact, you know, this isn't necessarily a narrative around their capabilities. It's a narrative of a whole sort of other thing, you know, a set of other things that need some attention before we start and completely get rid of remediation, which is now the trend.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right, right. So it seems that often these days community colleges are saying, well, we'll just gut the remediation, that's slowing down students. So instead of looking at the need for remediation as a symptom of the fact that some of our students who are coming in are not fully prepared to sit for a college course, they look at administrators look at remediation as the problem. So if we get rid of remediation, we'll get rid of the problem. A little bit like maybe it's too far afield of an analogy, but it seems a little bit like people who are promoting today, let's stop testing for COVID, because if we just stop testing, there'll be no more positive tests. Right, it will go away. Instead of looking at the test as a mechanism to determine underlying conditions.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great parallel. Yeah. And it's too bad. And I do think that this is, you know, again, driven by these same kind of, you know, neoliberal impulses of completion and quicker and faster. And, you know, at the same time, you know, I recognize that, you know, I've had students, really good students, really sharp students who could not graduate and could not take classes because they couldn't get through their remedial classes. And, you know, that, and as you know, I said, there some attention is deserved. The CUNY START program was one is an interesting example. And just so for our listeners, so CUNY START is a program for students who need a lot of remediation. So again, who scores on their entrance exams were pretty low, or on their high school index that they're now, where they start with just a semester of remediation, intensive remediation. They're not actually, it's through a kind of a separate but not so separate program. They're not taking any college level courses. I've had some students who have gone through the program and, you know, who were so thankful for that opportunity to really, you know, look and get their skills where it needed to be, and who've done very well in my classes. So that might be something to consider. I know that there's also research to suggest that the students should be encouraged to take remedial classes early on and to take it consistently, you know, rather than a hodgepodge. You know, so there's models out there to take a look at, but we have to, you know, I guess my concern will always be what is driving this and what is driving our evaluation of this. And, you know, how are we, you know, there's been some recent research in sort of the math remediation. This was done at CUNY, and I think it's been replicated elsewhere, where students were placed in three different groups. Students taking, they were all eligible for remedial math classes. One group took, and this was a randomized control trial experiment, one group took remedial math. So it's a kind of pre-algebra, I think. One group took the same class with a built-in tutoring, and then one class of students who were remedial eligible went straight to what we call Math 150, a statistics class, an intro to statistics. And the research showed very clearly that the students in this statistics class did much better. Their passing rates, their GPA was much better. So it called into question, so what are we doing with these remedial questions? My question is a methodological one, though, because those aren't equivalent courses, right? So I could imagine where students might really, especially if they have math phobia, which so many students experience, that they may be more enlightened, if you will, or engaged in the statistic course, since statistics we see clearly all around us, right? You can make it interesting to someone who's interested in sports or someone who's interested in, you know, all kinds of things.
Health,
right? Whereas an algebra class, you know, to get through that algebra, you know, may be more daunting or more phobic, you know, creating than a statistics class. So are they doing, you know, so, you know, I would love to see this kind of research replicated with the same course, you know, so like, but I don't know how you would do that because the remedial algebra course is a particular course, it may mean that we should be rethinking what remedial math we want to offer our students and what kinds of skills we want them to develop. And I think those are could be healthy conversations to have and important ones. But instead, we're just getting rid of them.
Right. And I have to say, when I was reading your book and thinking about this idea of the neoliberal or market-driven mindset and how it impacts on public education, I kept on thinking about this the book from Richard Hofstadter, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life from the 1960s. And he talks about how, you know, his argument is that many aspects of American life are really anti-intellectual, including capitalists, including business tycoons, and that he shows how, you know, throughout American history, essentially the business people looked down at education and said, why do we need it? You know, we need people who are able to be in the factory or able to be in the, run businesses. We don't need people to sit there reading all these books, you know? And then as, industrialization became more complex, and as businesses needed people who were able to do kind of higher level tasks, businessmen supported education, but essentially only to the extent that they felt that the education would be useful, quote unquote, for business, so that they weren't really interested in people reading Shakespeare or reading Homer or reading, philosophy books. They just wanted people who were technologically advanced enough to be able to fill the jobs that needed to be filled. And it seems to me like that's part of this basic outlook is still very much, you know, with us. When you talk about getting students to finish quickly, and that essentially all that the marketplace is valuing is the credential, the fact that a student has the diploma and they could say, yes, I checked off that box. Now I could go take an entry-level job at your company, you know, rather than saying, what is the true value of education and how could we be sure that our students are getting the most that they possibly can from their educational experience?
Right. Yeah. I think it serves, you know, that kind of thinking, I think, serves the status quo quite well, right? Because, you know, what do we gain? You know, what is a college education supposed to do? What is its purpose, right? And, you know, it's to deepen our intellectual capacities. It's to develop our ability to look at something and critically analyze it, right? We're seeing the breakdown of that in our political culture right now, including many of the people in the media. When I think about these things, I return to this question of equity. And, you know, so who is it higher education for and how, right? The more selective schools are still doing quite a good job of developing intellectual development and critical capacity. And if we are really serious about not only democratizing, but making higher ed equal and more equitable, we need to ensure that, you know, throughout our range of higher ed institutions, from the community college on up, we are, I say in the book, serving the students. You know, we are allowing for students, you know, we're planting seeds for students to flourish, and it's more than just a piece of paper, that at least that's my hope. I do think actually most of our students would want that. I mean, you can feel it, you can see it, you can hear it. Even from students who I think never thought of themselves as college students. I think when they are sitting in a classroom and feel respected and challenged and inspired, they thrive. And they should have that ability to thrive. If we really care about questions of equity and the purpose of higher ed.
Right. Absolutely. And to go back to a comment you made earlier, you mentioned the so-called college completion crisis. So just to address that directly, is there a crisis in community colleges that students are not completing their degrees in a timely manner? Or is this framing of the issue itself deeply kind of problematic and off base?
Well, I actually think it's both. I mean, I do think that the statistics warrant some attention. You know, when you say that, you know, in 2019, for example, so just to clarify some terms, so the retention rate is the rate that the students returning to the same school that they first started. Persistence is students return from 1 year to this first 1 year to year two. Persistence is students returning to any school. So that's the distinction made in a lot of the data. There's a few things here. So how do we measure timely graduation, right? Is 2 year ineffective? No longer. 3 year, which is still commonly used, not really also going to adequately reflect how students go to college. There is more recently, just prior to COVID, an attempt to extend the calendars to 6 year, to 8 year, to see. And, you know, you do that and you do see racial and ethnic gaps close in terms of graduation rates. You do see graduation rates increase. Some of the problem is that, in one of the chapters, I take a deep dive into the way in which the data is generated. What data sets do we use? And, you know, we have a problem right now with a kind of a fetishization around data. So, you know, we show me the data, you know, data driven, and these mantras you hear all over the place. It's very easy to show numbers, but if they're not given any kind of context, or you don't question, well, how is the data generated, your analysis is underdeveloped. And so if you include or don't exclude from your data students who have no intention to graduate. So, you know, at CUNY, we have the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and a lot of our police force who go to college take their, do their education there. Well, for the police academy, from what I understand, you only need a certain number of credits, and then you go straight onto the police academy. So, for example, John Jay's graduation rate has often been very low, but that's because the vast majority of their students never intended to graduate. And so with community college, if you don't consider the transfer effect when you're looking at the graduation rates, which many of our rates don't, it's not an accurate understanding of how many students who start there, who intend to graduate there, because most of our students do say they want to transfer. And so it becomes this muddy mess of, so crisis, I think, I don't like to use the word crisis because I think it becomes co-opted in that way that Naomi Klein helped us see with the shock doctrine, you know, effect of, you know, again, what neoliberalism does, it creates a crisis, and then we find ways to address the crisis that is in accordance with this sort of corporate model. And that's, you know, I lay this out in the book. But that's not to say I'm not, you know, concerned, and nor we should be concerned with whether our students are able to retain and graduate in a timely way, whatever that means. I mean, I think that part of this, focus on momentum and graduation has really pushed aside the vast majority of our community college students nationwide who are part-time students, because the academic momentum theory says, you know, part-time students are the least likely to stick with it. But we know from CUNY, even though they're the minority percentage in terms of, enrollment intensity, part-time students are often part-time students for very good reasons. There's no amount of money, effort, time, whatever, that's going to make them transform to part-time to full-time. We found that out in our project when we tried. And so rather than pushing them aside, or rather than only focusing on getting students to take more classes, maybe we should create better ways and better pathways for these part-time students who should be able to have it, you know. And you should be able to have a good education. And I guess maybe this is, you know, my own family history with my grandmother, who I never got to meet, who, you know, put herself through downtown, City College downtown, one class at a time while raising two kids on her own, you know, in the 1940s and 50s. And she did it. And it took her a really long time, but she was able to do it. And I want students of today to be able to do that, even if they do it slowly. And I do think that that's an important function of a community college, to be able to enable that.
Right. So in essence, you're saying that if community colleges adopt a market-driven model for success that says that students must complete their degree in X number of years, it's a very rigid model, and by definition, it excludes all sorts of possible avenues for degree completion that may be very necessary for particular groups of students. But if you are only looking at a very narrow framing of what success means, those students and those avenues that they would, in theory, pursue become eliminated.
True. Yeah. I mean, you know, and I think we can see this in all kinds of ways. I mean, you know, one of the examples I mentioned in the book. So for the period, I think it was 2000, it was a 5-year period. So it must have been 2012 to 2017, I think. A community college saw a real substantial increase in graduation rates. And again, this was during this, you know, kind of height of momentum kind of programs and policies. But at the same time, they also saw the highest rates of students going on academic probation. And you have to wonder, well, what is the correlation? You know, is there a reason why at the same time you can have high graduation rates and high, and for those of you, you know, academic probation just means that students are doing very poorly academically in their classes, and there's consequences for that. Like they, you know, have to stop, you know, attending school for a while, if not, you know. And so that's, I think, an example that it really speaks to what you just asked, you know, and a kind of, and it's also, I think, what it happens when we design policies really without really knowing who the students are and why, you know, how and why they enroll. And, you know, I talk about this concept that I call the student sensibility. And I draw from a variety of different traditions in sociology and different theoretical traditions, from Bourdieu to Arlie Hochschild to Annette Leroux, that really talks about how students see themselves as students and their attunement to being a student, and all that they, without trying to portray this as a deficit, but just as an understandable consequence of, you know, again, the absence of family socialization around college going, the absence of knowing a whole lot of people who go to college, knowing that it's important for careers and the workforce, but not really being brought in as a place for intellectual development. And I think that we need to be better informed and better attuned to who our students are, what they want from college, what they know and don't know, before we start full-scale change that is supposed to improve their completion rates.
Right. And in the final chapter of your book, you present an alternative paradigm to neoliberal education based on the concept of caring institutions. What do you mean by that term?
So I was fortunate enough to be a student back in my days with Joan Tronto, who is one of the, the foremothers of care theory and the ethics of care. And she has deeply influenced the way I think about just about everything from Marx on up. She talks about, so when we say care, it's not just an activity. It's not a disposition. It's all of that. Like, we are deeply embedded in our relationships with others, and we come into this world in need of care, and we leave this world very often in need of care. And to to understand how our relationships are really dramatically centered on caring for and giving care to others. It is actually what makes us human. And so it has long been held as an opposing theory to this, you know, the self-actualized, individual, person of certainly the liberal tradition and political philosophy. When it comes to institutions, I think that a lot of the theory behind this idea of caring relationships, you know, it gets tricky. Can an institution really care about people? What I draw out in the last chapter is not only an antithetical model, but I also take a look at the way in which the care language has been already co-opted and brought into the institution in a kind of way that we that in business we call emotional branding. Right. So, you know, we see this here at CUNY when we're, you know, there's lots of talk and discussion about a culture of care that, you know, so we're addressing the needs of students. And this is coming out of real research that, you know, also we need to be attuned to about, you know, students who are struggling with housing insecurity and food insecurity and mental health issues. And we absolutely need more institutional support to respond to these needs. But what we're doing is we're sort of crafting it as a way to say we're responding with, you know, we're formally without caring in substance. And I don't mean that staff don't care about students at all or faculty. I'm not suggesting that. But like, you know, having a food pantry in a community college is really great and really important. But that's only, you know, the start. and, you know, in a real caring institution, again, following the kind of theoretical tradition of the ethics of care, everyone in that institution, every one of their needs to be cared for. And what we see in this use of care is that the students are cared about, but the people doing the care work, their needs are not met. So whether it's the exploited, you know, adjunct part-time faculty member, or the overworked and understaffed, you know, staff person in you know, oversubscribed and understaffed offices. And we highlight these very sort of, you know, emotional heart, what's that word called when you plug, you tug at the heartstrings of, you know, the faculty men, the faculty person who, you know, went to the hospital to give the oral exam to the student lying in bed, you know, like, and these are these examples that are highlighted and while they're beautiful, like A, that's not sustainable. And B, you know, like what gets left out of the picture, certainly from a, you know, an important Marxist standpoint is, well, what happens to the, you know, the labor that is in, you know, is required to carry out that, you know, that care work. And so that the labor of those who work in institutions are rendered even more invisible than they already are. And this is sort of the problem. So, you know, I try to, you know, I wanted to end the book with some practical ways in which we can move forward. And again, in this sort of ethic of care, more expanded and more substantive than it often is, I think we really need to address the lack of mental health care support services. I think that there should be a psychiatrist on every community college campus, or at least access to that, not to mention more mental health counselors. I think offering more employment opportunities to students that are on campus. You know, I'm. You know, it was Sarah Goldrick Robb's book, "Paying the Price." She had a whole section on the work study program and how it tends to be, you know, more pronounced at places where students, you know, not at community colleges, in other words. You know, we do have work study students. I don't know the percentages. It's something I actually want to look into more readily, but I'm surprised by the lack of, you know, whether it's financially, you know, aid subsidized or other kinds of work site possibilities that could not only help the institutions run, but it could offer students a way to stay on campus without having to travel so much to work. It can open up doors of opportunities and people who they meet and other kinds of resources. It can make this school feel more that it's for them. Like, I do think that, and I'm kind of returning to what we said in the beginning, you know, I don't think these other aspects, these non-academic factors that I think are really important get lost in the momentum prioritization, right? The sense of belonging, the feeling of validation. You know, we heard it while doing the project, but I hear in my among my students, I advise and teach all the time, so I'm not here to make friends, you know? And I respect that, but like, friendship and friendship networks, like that is a huge part of the college experience. And what could it look like if community college were able to provide possibilities for that? And it is hard for them when they're running from class to work and fitting in family responsibilities. But in what ways can we address those very particular needs better? And that is what I don't think is happening in the discourse and the practices around the completion crisis.
Right. Well, there's so much more to talk about your book. It's really a fascinating and really important and timely work. But for today, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting me. This was a real treat.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.